90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today, our guest is no stranger to our show, and we're happy that he's going to spend time with us this morning, as well as his deputy director, Dr. Rex Archer, is our guest this morning. Good morning, Dr. Archer. Are you there, sir?
Well, good morning. How are you?
I am doing well. So, Dr. Archer is still coming to us via our KKFI studio line, and we're also social distancing. So we'll jump right into it because this time is critical this morning. Dr. Archer, it was just a year ago that the first cases of the coronavirus made it to the metropolitan area in Johnson County, Kansas. And since then, we've had 572,000 cases of COVID and 8,727 deaths in the state of Missouri. Jackson County has had 36,463 cases and 392 deaths. Many people are still worried about contracting COVID. Can you provide the latest seven-day average for the metropolitan area?
So the last 7 days were at 48 new cases reported per day. But I want to make it very clear, we know that is an underestimate because people aren't testing as often now. Those numbers are coming from folks that, in a sense, often have to be tested because they're going into the hospital for a procedure. They are actually folks that are less likely to have been exposed because they've been more careful. So we know that that's an underestimate by quite a bit. The good news is that our number of hospitalizations has been dropping, particularly in January and then again in February. And so far that trend is holding up in March, but it's not going down as fast right now.
And you jumped to that, so I'll move around a little bit on what I wanted to talk about. For the first time since last March, the University of Kansas Hospital has less than 10 acute COVID-19 cases. Why are we seeing such a dramatic reduction in acute COVID cases and hospitalizations?
Well, there are several factors. There's no question that more and more people are serious about wearing masks. And in fact, in some cases, what we call double masking to make sure that the mask is tight and working effectively. We've all seen folks that their mask is down under their nose or so forth, and that both means that they could be spreading the disease to others as well as becoming infected. Double masking reduces the chance that the mask will drop down below the nose. It also provides a better fit around the rest of the mouth. So that's one of the factors. Another major factor is that we've got people to stay social distance further and further apart from each other. And then the third that really is nice to be seeing now is that we had the vaccine and we've been prioritizing the folks that are most likely to die or be hospitalized to get vaccinated. And that's definitely working and helping now, regardless of which vaccine is out there. Anybody who gets a chance to get vaccinated with any of those three that are currently available should take it because all those trials with all those three vaccines, there were zero deaths and there were almost zero, I mean, with a rounding error, the number of folks that were hospitalized with any of these, even now with some of the new variants that have slight differences, the chances of you being hospitalized or dying if you've been fully vaccinated is as close to zero as possible. More importantly than just that is the chances that you then spread the disease to your loved ones goes way down also. It's not perfect, and that's why we need to continue to wear masks, but you can reduce the chances that you might have the disease and not know it and pass it to others also by being vaccinated.
As we are talking about the vaccination, we're going to talk about it more next week because we've got three pharmacists coming on. We're going to talk about all three different vaccinations. But what one thing people need to understand is that the vaccination does not prevent you from getting COVID. What it does do is it prevents that if you get COVID, you get a severe case that could either lead to hospitalization or death. Is that correct, Dr. Rex Archer?
That's mostly correct, Mr. Jackson. The it actually does look like it reduces the chances of you getting the virus a little bit, and it does appear also to reduce the amount of virus that you then shed and expose others to. So, but it's not 100% there. The 100% protection is the protection from death and from hospitalization, basically. But yes, you're correct. You can still get it, but a much milder case. And that's actually the way that the influenza shot works in most cases, most years, is it may be enough to prevent death and hospitalization, but sometimes doesn't prevent milder cases. But again, you're less likely to infect as many more people. And anytime we have a pandemic, and if on average each person who becomes infected infects less than one other person, the pandemic goes away. So it can actually help us from that standpoint too, but it's not perfect.
Dr. Archer, as we see the dramatic reductions in the number of hospitalizations, not only in Kansas City, Missouri, and around the nation, COVID cases are dropping also, as we've seen. Multiple states have eliminated the mask mandate, such as Texas and Mississippi. Are we at a point where we should be eliminating the mask mandate?
Heck no. I don't know how to say that any stronger than that. It's just this is absolutely not the time to be doing that. There are still folks that are waiting to be vaccinated. And if we care about those who haven't had a chance to get vaccinated yet, we need to make sure that we're reducing the level of virus spreading through the community. Do I like wearing a mask? Absolutely not. I mean, it's uncomfortable. You know, sometimes I have a little bit of mild asthma, and it's not as easy to breathe through the mask. But I don't want to be responsible for passing the virus on to somebody else, even though because I'm over 65 and have other pre-existing conditions, I have been vaccinated, but I don't want to take the chance that I have a mild case that I don't know about and I spread it to somebody else. So, no, we still need to be wearing masks, and I would expect that will happen through much of the summer. Now, once we've gone several months and everybody that wants to be vaccinated has been vaccinated, then I think we could start having conversations about, you know, unfortunately, not everybody is going to get vaccinated that should. But then that kind of becomes their personal responsibility. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out over the summer.
So, Dr. Archer, what age range right now are we seeing the greatest increase in COVID-19 cases?
We're seeing here in March fairly even across the board from age 20 to around just under 60. Most of those groups are about the same in regards to infection. Fortunately, the folks over 60, many of them now are getting vaccinated because they either have pre-existing conditions, et cetera, and or they're still avoiding being around other folks. And that's one of the things that we may talk about in a little while here is the, some of the recommended changes in CDC in regards to restrictions once you've been vaccinated. The concern that we have to some degree is what is going to be happening in the under 20-year-olds, the 10 to 19 and the under 10s, as schools are opening up and this new variant might be taking hold that seems to be more contagious. But so far, we're not seeing a huge increase in either of those populations. But I'll also be honest, we are not testing those folks in those populations very well right now, and they often have low enough symptoms of disease that they're not that ill to get sick. So in the past, it's been pretty safe because they don't spread it much to each other and don't spread it to adults. But this new variant, we've got to be watching very carefully.
And that 20-something age range is hidden right in my next question. Dr. Spring break will be upon us in a few weeks, and many college students will flock to warm weather states such as Texas with no mask mandate, and Florida, who's looking at releasing their mask mandate, to party. Could we see another round of even more potential COVID cases due to these thousands of students who are leaving their places, going back, and then going back to thousands of cities across the United States?
There's no question that we have not gotten this pandemic fully under control yet, and to be opening up in these, I was going to use the term silly ways, but it's worse than just silly. It's unethical and just plain dangerous to be doing this. I have a lot of concern about that right now. We know that any place where masks are not being worn, this virus will continue to spread.
Dr. Archer, as you mentioned earlier, we were talking about the two new strains of coronavirus, the one found in South Africa and the one found in England. These strains are more easily transmitted from person to person, and they are here in the United States. Have we had any signs of these new strains in the metropolitan area?
As mentioned a little bit earlier, we have some evidence of very, very small percentages, in most cases under 1%, of the virus that's detected in wastewater treatment is of these new strains. But that can change fairly rapidly, and just as we have seen with most holidays over the last year where people break down and aren't wearing masks and are getting together in indoor environments, we've seen increases 2 to 3 weeks after those events of fairly significant increases. It would not surprise me to see one or both of those viruses or some new one that, there's a California variant, there's some others out there. The other thing that I would just kind of mention at this point, and we may get to it a little bit later in detail, is that, this isn't the only infectious disease out there. This isn't the only one that can take off and become a pandemic. The next 1918-19 flu pandemic could start on a pig farm in Missouri. And fortunately, this week, the federal government and Senator Murray from state of Washington, with huge numbers of co-sponsors and over 100 different organizations, are sponsoring the Public Health Infrastructure Saves Lives Act, because we were caught flat-footed with this pandemic because we'd underfunded our public health infrastructure system, our lab testing capabilities, all the different things that we need to manage any type of an outbreak. We are still not testing enough of these viruses to look at whether the variants are here yet or not. So that is a big concern.
So, Dr. Archer, in the state of Missouri, we are fully vaccinated, meaning the people have received two shots, 9.16% of the state. Kansas is fully vaccinated, 9.0% of its state's population. How are we doing vaccinating residents in the metropolitan area?
So, the numbers are actually increasing pretty quickly right now. The most recent numbers that I've seen actually for Missouri is now up around 16.5%. So basically one out of every six folks has had one vaccine. The difference between whether you've been fully vaccinated with that second dose or whether you have the first dose and you're at least 2 weeks on doesn't change your overall chances of death or hospitalization very much. The main reason for the booster is to spread the length of time that you're protected. So I actually like to focus on have they had that first shot. Kansas City finally is now getting its data broken out separately. We were previously included just in Jackson, Clay, and Platt County. I mean, we do have 200 residents that live down in Cass, but it's not a huge percentage of their population. So we are falling behind the state average by quite a bit. And we've been making this known. The allocation of vaccine coming to Region A has been basically 40,000 doses. We're behind what we should be just on a population basis. The governor has acknowledged this and is resetting the funding formulas. So rather than us getting 20% of the statewide vaccine for Region A that Kansas City is part of when we were 23% of the state's population, we'll now be getting 24% of the state's vaccine coming to Kansas City. That's a huge increase, and that will help us get to more of our minority populations. As you fully know, our Latino Hispanic populations are dying twice as often per person per capita than our white populations, and our black population is at least 50% higher death rates. So we really need to get the word out and do more vaccination in those areas, because it's not just the over 65 that are dying throughout the metro and in Kansas City. We're having deaths all the way down into folks in the 20s.
But what people may need to also understand is that if you have COVID, you can't get, it's not recommended that you get the vaccine. You wait until after you've overcome COVID in that case to get receive the vaccine, correct?
If you are 100% certain that you have COVID, yes. In general, if you had just gotten the shingles shot or something like that, we recommend waiting a week or two before you get the COVID vaccination. And the reason is that to get the maximum benefit from the vaccine, it's good to not be fighting something else at that time so that your body can respond to the vaccine. And I do want to just mention to everybody, this is not a live virus. You cannot get COVID from the vaccine. It's is designed to mimic part of the virus's outside appearance, so that the way our immune system works is we recognize that virus as foreign, and our body can then get rid of the virus and attack it faster if we have been kind of pre-warned. So it's that early building up of the ability of the body to react, and that's why it's been 100% effective in all the trials at preventing death and hospitalization.
And I want to thank you for that, because that is one of the biggest myths that are circulating in the African-American community, that by taking the COVID vaccination, they're giving you COVID, and that it's a live vaccination, which truly you've just said it's not. So that's one of the things that people need to understand. And, you know, if you don't know where to get your information, the Center for Disease Control, kcmo.gov/COVID. There's quality information out there that will dispel all of these myths.
Yeah, one of my long-term 30-plus years colleague, Dr. Jenny Kane, who is the director for Indianapolis, Marion County, Indiana, past president of the American Public Health Association, a leader in the Black Physicians National Medical Association. She's been very involved in these trials and making sure that all the vaccination companies had good representation of Blacks and Latino Hispanics, so that the trials were done to test the safety and effectiveness. One of the things that is just so tragic from the Tuskegee situation, where folks were denied treatment years ago, and 300 individuals were not given treatment. And the distrust and the mistrust that is created by that has been horrendous. Clinton apologized for that, even though obviously he wasn't part of that, but nationally apologized for it. The problem now is that because of the mistrust, when folks decide to not get vaccinated, in effect, folks are now Tuskegeeing themselves. They are denying themselves an effective treatment, and they are denying the chance of preventing the spread in their community to harm others that they love. And when folks... this pandemic has been a pandemic of racial injustice and economic injustice that the virus has taken advantage of. So if anything, we need our Black and brown communities to vaccinate at higher rates than our white community, because they're at increased risk for this disease.
And you are so correctly that a study that ended in the 70s, almost 50 years later, is still holding such power over a community, that because of the mistrust that was built during that. And what I say to people is, study for yourself, do your own homework and find out, because nothing could be worse than you taking a case of COVID home, because a lot of people in Black and brown communities live in multi-generational homes. So you may have the mother, the grandmother, you know, the grandchildren, in some cases great-grandchildren, all living under the same roof, and you could bring home a case of COVID and do harm to your parents and your grandparents, whose immune systems are not as fully able to fight it off as those in their 20s.
Yeah, absolutely. We know that the fact that we don't have national paid sick leave for workers and quarantine leave has been one of the reasons that we have had more deaths in this country than other countries have had, because sick workers have been able to stay home and still not lose a paycheck and be able to make their rent or put food on the table for their family. And that's been a challenge. There are a lot of things that we need to lessons learned from this pandemic to strengthen ourselves to make the next pandemic less less damaging. I do just recommend folks to look around, you know, talk with your doctors. Vice President Harris has gotten vaccinated. I wouldn't be getting vaccinated if I didn't know how safe this vaccine is and what a difference it makes. Yes, you can have a little bit of a sore arm, or some people get a little bit of a headache, but that's a little better than death. Yes, after the booster, I was pretty tired the next day. That's why I happened to get lucky, and I could get the shot on a Friday, so I had a lighter work weekend that weekend, so I was able to make it through the day or two that I was tired after the booster. But I really, really strongly encourage everybody to get vaccinated. And I also want folks to know, if you've signed up on our website or have called in, if you aren't as able to do that, and we've had folks on the phone kind of get you signed up so that you can be notified, you do need to learn how to figure out whether you're getting a mail spam blocker that's blocking our communication to you, because we're finding folks that have signed up and then don't seem to ever be getting notifications. The same thing, if you don't like answering your phone when you don't know what number's calling you, if you're signed up to get this vaccine, you may need to answer your phone every time and then hang up if it's somebody trying to sell you something you don't want. But don't not answer the phone, because you may be getting your call to get vaccinated.
That's right. So check that junk mail. I can say this. I happened to get my first shot on, it was just kind of walked in, and they actually had some. And then a lot of people don't know that when they schedule your first shot, they schedule the second. So having had the first and the second shot, the sore arm was, the first one I had a little bit of a sore arm. The second one I had a little bit more of a sore arm. But comparing that to the COVID case that I had that in November, December, and I received my case from somebody who was shedding a lot, who had been sick, but they didn't want to, you know, go get the quarantine and do the things they needed to do. So then they passed it on to me. But I then turned around and stayed home for 3.5 weeks and didn't pass it on to anybody else. You know, we can defeat this, but we have to work together.
And thank you for sharing that, because one of the things that influences people getting the shot as much as anything else is having somebody they know, that they trust, that they hear from, folks like you that are important radio personalities that folks learn to trust. That really can help, Joe, get folks to be vaccinated.
We have to look at that, knowing it. And I talked to a couple of people yesterday that, you know, one guy said, well, yeah, he was out of the Marines. He said, you know, we in the military, we receive so many different vaccinations that people just, you know, it's one more different. You know, we weren't even told what was in it. We weren't even told if it had emergency use or was approved. They just said, walk down the line and take the shot. And he said he took the Johnson & Johnson shot because some people are taking that because it's one shot. But, folks, the vaccine will save lives. And if you get COVID, it will make it less. And those last 7 days that I went through, I wouldn't wish that on anybody, because the pain, the difficulty breathing, all those different things. But if you know, if you think you're sick or you know you may be coming down with something, stay away from anybody else, because you don't want to pass on that to somebody and then they not be able to effectively fight it off as you have. And I can say that because I know people who got COVID at the same time. There's a young man, his dad, I've known him since he's four. His dad got COVID at the same time I did. He was in his mid-50s, and he didn't survive COVID. So it doesn't take any hostages. It doesn't care what color you are, you know. And in our community, we have a lot of pre-existing conditions that make us more susceptible to COVID. So what I'm saying to folks is definitely the vaccination is scientifically based. It does work. And you can help save lives, not only yours, but maybe somebody that you may know, because you won't shed as much of the virus if you actually do get the virus after that.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to conclude this time. And I know you've got my great deputy, Frank Thompson, coming on next. You know, the fact that we've had 530-plus deaths in Kansas City, Missouri, none of which would have needed to have happened if we'd had the vaccine. Probably 80% of those wouldn't have had to happen if the nation had been under a national mask mandate and had paid sick and quarantine leave for folks and had a public health infrastructure that could have stopped this outbreak like, you know, New Zealand and Australia and other countries were successful at doing it. So we need to learn lessons from this. But right now, the best way that we as Kansas City can show our love for each other is to get vaccinated and continue to wear our masks.
Thank you so much for that, Dr. Archer. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Frank Thompson, who's the Deputy Director of the Kansas City, Missouri Health Department. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break. And we're back. This is Joseph Jackson, host of Cowtown Conversations here on 90.1 FM. And our guest for the second segment of our show is Mr. Frank Thompson. He's the Deputy Director of the Kansas City, Missouri Health Department. Are you there, Mr. Thompson?
Yes, I am. How are you doing today, Joseph?
I'm doing great in yourself, sir. So yeah, you hope you were able to catch some of the first part with Dr. Archer. So we're going to kind of step in a little bit of that. So, Mr. Thompson, what activities can those who have been fully vaccinated with their second dose and pass the 14-day point safely resume at this time?
Well, as Dr. Archer said during his part of the interview, once people are vaccinated, it's still important to remember that people can get infected and can pass the virus. The risk of that is much lower for those that are vaccinated. But it is still possible. So just because you're vaccinated doesn't mean you can rip the mask off. You know, I've also received both of my shots, and I still continue to wear a mask in certain situations, like when I'm shopping or when I know I'm going to be around a lot of folks that, you know, I don't know what their safety practices are, how diligent they are about protecting themselves from the virus. I double mask. You know, so I think in terms of what people can resume, I think people can feel a little safer about dining out. I think it's still important to observe, make sure that you're dining in a location that, you know, the servers are wearing masks, that people who, once they finish eating and they're just sitting and chatting, that they're wearing masks. You know, it's all about, you know, selecting locations that you're going to patronize based on their willingness and effort to protect you. That is something I do. There are certain stores that I no longer go into because as I watch the behavior of customers and then the response of management to those customers, I know that their interest is not in protecting me from the virus. And so I think even after folks are vaccinated, they still have to be diligent about where you're going and what's the level of observance of both mask wearing and social distance in that location. It's really not until we've gotten the majority of the population vaccinated and we've reached what's called herd immunity that we can start talking about really backing off of all of the restrictions.
And as you bring that up, and a lot of people, I've talked to people who seem to believe that because we vaccinated almost a fifth of the state's population, and we receive, we're at the point of herd immunity, and I'm like, we're not even close. Mr. Thompson, what, how many people would have to be vaccinated in order for us to get to the point of reaching herd immunity?
You know, typically herd immunity, you've got to be somewhere between 70% and 80% of your population vaccinated before you reach what's considered herd immunity. You know, so for a city the size of Kansas City, you know, that would, you know, that would be over 300,000 of our adult population vaccinated.
And what is meant by that term herd immunity, so people will understand what it actually really is?
Basically what herd immunity is about is the, and Dr. Archer talked a little bit about this in his part of the interview, that the way you stop a pandemic or an outbreak is you reduce the amount of spread. So you want to get, if somebody gets infected, you don't want them passing that to more than one person. That's how you keep it under control and get rid of it. What happens in herd immunity is it just, it lessens the likelihood of you being exposed to the virus, because there are now more people in the community who have been vaccinated or who have had the disease and therefore have immunity from having had the disease. You're less likely to come in contact with the virus. So that means you're obviously less likely to get infected, which means you're less likely to pass it on. And when you multiply that across the population, that's what then really keeps the outbreak under control or ends it. So it's, herd immunity is not just about I'm protected. Herd immunity is about the level of virus that's circulating in the community has been reduced to a level that we can keep transmission under control.
Mr. Thompson, Missouri is currently vaccinating phase 1A, phase 1B tier 1, phase 1B tier 2, and will move to phase 1B tier 3 on March 15th. Can you explain who is eligible for vaccinations under current Missouri guidelines?
Under current Missouri guidelines, that phase 1B tier 2 that you talked about, which is, you know, probably the largest of the current tiers, that includes individuals over the age of 65, and then individuals with specific health conditions. And I'm trying to find my copy of that actual. I'll come back to that in a second.
Okay.
Phase one was folks in long-term care facilities and skilled nursing facilities and healthcare workers. They were in phase one because they were the people most likely, in the case of those in skilled nursing facilities and long-term care facilities, they were the ones to most likely have severe outcomes, either hospitalization or death from the virus. In the case of healthcare workers, they were on the front lines being exposed every day. So it was important to get those two populations covered first. The phase 1B tier 1 included a lot of essential workers, public works, water, those types of workers, security. We in Missouri, they eventually put police and fire into that tier. So it's basically all of the essential folks that basically keep our cities running. And then we moved into phase two, which was those with chronic conditions and those over the age of 65. Once tier three opens up next week, that's a much larger population. It includes teachers, it includes child care. It also includes food service workers. So that is a population we're beginning to look at. We're in that tier three group. We're trying to prioritize teachers and get them vaccinated first. because many of the schools are planning to go back into session. And although it's possible for the schools to go, it is entirely possible for the schools to go back to in-person learning without all the teachers being vaccinated. It, having them all vaccinated just makes that a safer proposition. That tier also includes some additional government workers, including elected officials. Again, looking at who are those people that are necessary to keep your city and your infrastructure running. So we will be moving to each of those groups in turn as we move to, through this new tier once it opens.
So, Mr. Thompson, many African Americans and Latinos have pre-existing conditions such as diabetes, hypertension, and other conditions that make them more susceptible to contracting COVID-19. How does having a pre-existing condition make you more susceptible to the coronavirus?
What all of those pre-existing conditions do is, in one way or another, they reduce your body's ability to fight off infections. In fact, with diabetes, people know it as a blood condition. But one of the things that's most insidious about diabetes is the fact that it lowers your body's ability to fight off infection. Hence the amputations that people experience because they get an injury to one of their extremities, hand, foot. And their body can't fight off the infection, so it spreads. So all of those conditions have the underlying effect of impacting your immune system. And once your immune system is impacted, you can't fight off the virus. Or your body can't mount any kind of response to the virus.
So we're opening up the new tier next week. How can people who live in the metropolitan area who may not have signed up under Tier 1B or 1A or Tier 1B Phase 2 who are not eligible under Tier 1B Phase 3, how can they sign up to get a vaccination if they want to get a vaccination?
They can definitely go to the city's website, kcmo.gov/coronavirus, and our contact form is on there. They can also call 311, and 2 weeks ago, we got a change to the 311 system. Previously, you had to go through some different menus in order to get to the COVID call center. Now, when you call 311, that COVID call center is option number one. So it is the very first option that is made available to people. But I also want to say this. People shouldn't wait until their tier opens up to sign up on that contact form. It's important that people get their names on now because one of the things we use that contact form for is planning. So if we know we've got X number of individuals in this next tier coming up, that helps us to plan for that. So I would encourage I would really encourage folks to not only sign up on our website. Unfortunately, right now we have different providers of vaccine that all have their own websites. We are working on possible solutions for being able to link those on the backside, but that has not come to fruition yet. But for right now, folks should really be signing up for every list you're eligible for. So the state has its vaccine navigator. Even though there are some issues with that, folks should sign up on that state vaccine navigator because as the state rolls out mass vaccination events, that's how they're pulling people to set appointments for those events. You've got some high throughput vaccinators here in Kansas City, Truman Medical Center, St. Luke's, and in the Northland. You've got a partnership between Liberty Hospital and North Kansas City Hospital. So they're doing their mass event. They also have their own sign-up list. And we really encourage people, every list that you're eligible on. So if you're a resident of Kansas City, Missouri, but you live in Clay County, you should also be doing the Clay County list. It's unfortunate that our system has devolved into that, but it's a symptom of lack of leadership at the beginning of this pandemic from the top down. In terms of creating this as a national response versus a whole series of local responses.
And I will add to that is that if you are a veteran and you serve in any of our nation's military branches, the Veterans Administration is giving COVID vaccinations for those who receive treatment there. So if you're a veteran, you receive treatment at the VA, VA here, maybe the one in Wyandotte County, the one in Leavenworth in Kansas, call them here, 816-4700, and ask to see, because right now, I know a couple of months back when I went for my first shot, they had to vaccinate 1,600 people on one day, 1,600 people the next day, and it was during a period when the weather was bad, and they just sent out a message to anybody and said, people are not showing up. The vaccine has been opened. It has to be used. If we can't use it, then it goes. And they had about 200 people just come in, and that's how people were able to get the vaccine ahead of their time, because other people didn't show up in the clinics that already been scheduled. And I know right now they're running at 100% utilization rate. So that means that 100% of their shots are going into 100% of their arms. So if you're a veteran, you served, or you know somebody that's a veteran that served, because when I got the message, I sent out to other people, and they were like, they were able to get their shots. And when they were scheduled for their first shot, they were given the schedule for their second shot. So there are ways, if you want it. Wyandotte County is definitely, anybody over 65 lives in KCK, call 311 in KCK, and you can go down and get a vaccination today. So it is available and out there for those that want to get a vaccination in many cases.
And that actually brings up something else I want to emphasize. Even though I just said, sign up on as many lists as you can in order to increase your chances of getting a vaccine opportunity earlier rather than later, the one thing we are asking people to do is do not accept multiple appointments. Because when people do that, it creates exactly the situation you just described. A vaccine site is set up, and there is a significant number of people who don't show up for their appointments because they've already gotten a vaccination somewhere else. And then there's a scramble to get those vaccine doses administered. So rather than vaccinating the priority population that we need to focus on, we end up vaccinating people who may not be part of those priority populations. So that's the one caveat to that, signing up on multiple lists is please, please, please do not accept multiple appointments.
You can only get one, and you have to have at least between 21 to 28 days between that first and second shot. So folks, you can't go out and you got on one list today and you got a shot and then go back, the next list calls you next week. It doesn't work like that. So the request that you have 21 days between one shot, 28 days between on the other one that's done. So they will go over that information when you get your shots. Mr. Thompson, we have a flu shot, a pneumonia shot. Will the coronavirus vaccination become a yearly vaccination, a booster like the flu shot?
They are still going through the data from clinical trials. They're still following those individuals in the clinical trials. It's important to note that, we don't have a full year of data on what these vaccines, what the longevity of these vaccines are. There is a lot in the literature that says this probably will become an annual vaccination, like the flu vaccine. So that is, yeah, that is very much a possibility, but it is not a definite yet.
And we'll end with this one. Mr. Thompson, we're talking about those who should take the shot. Are there any conditions that people may have where they shouldn't get vaccinated?
Those will be discussed with the person who's providing you the vaccination. There's a whole screening protocol. People who have severe allergic reactions to certain foods and nuts either should not or should receive that shot in a in a closely supervised situation. For example, Truman Medical Center, for some of the people it is vaccinating, they actually have a specialized clinic set up right next to their ER. So that if any of those individuals do have a severe reaction, they can immediately get them into the ER. So, yes, there are some populations that should not receive that vaccine, but I would say don't try to self-diagnose that. Really talk to your medical provider. If you don't have a regular medical provider, when you go to your vaccination site, have a conversation with the person who is about to give you that shot. Don't just sit there and passively answer the questions. Really share what your history is. And don't worry that I think some people approach that, well, if I tell that, then I'm not going to get vaccinated, and that means I'm still at risk. There will be opportunities for folks to get vaccinated. Even ourselves, one of the things we did when we first started distributing vaccine is we set up a special clinic on Thursdays here at the health department for individuals that we identified at other locations who, because of some indication, shouldn't receive that vaccine there. So we did a specialized clinic. Our team has gone through some additional training and has revised their screening protocol so that now we're able to do more of those folks in our regular clinics. But it is still something that we watch for, is those individuals that have a history of severe allergic reactions.
So thank you so much to yourself, Mr. Thompson, and Dr. Rex Archer, Director of Kansas City, Missouri Health Department, for being our guest today. We never end Cowtown Conversations without our Community Minute. So daylight savings time starts this Saturday, folks. That means kind of we're getting out of winter. So remember to set your clocks for 1 hour. Also, if you're a veteran and you served and you received care at the VA hospital, give them a call, 816-861-4700, to look at getting a coronavirus vaccination through them. And also, if you live in Wyandotte County and you're age 65 or over, anybody who wants a shot can get a shot. You just have to have a utility bill to prove that you live within Wyandotte County. So live in Kansas, call 311 to set yourself up, or contact the health department there in KCK. So for Cowtown Conversations, I've been your host, Joseph Jackson. Join us next week when we'll have pharmacists from Truman Medical Center, and we'll be talking about the Pfizer, the Moderna, and the newly EAU-authorized Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Stay tuned for My Place with Larry J. Wear a mask and stay safe.
I'm Lisa Hardwick, president of the Deed Foundation and the Delta Athenaeum, where the suffrage movement in Kansas City took root. I want to talk to you for a few minutes about that movement. When Congress ratified the 19th Amendment giving American women the right to vote in 1920, it reflected generations of work by suffragists of all races and backgrounds. Historically, attention has focused on the efforts of white movement leaders like Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. But across the nation, there were many black women who joined in the battle for suffrage while also fighting racism and discrimination. Black women weren't always welcomed in the movement because many of the white leaders were worried that their involvement would lessen the willingness of the power structure to give them the right to vote. So many of the black women were left to advocate for the right to vote on their own, and that they did. In the Kansas City area, Ida Bowman Becks is among the most influential. Born in 1880, Ms. Becks established the first Urban League chapter in Kansas City and served on the board of directors. Using that platform, she was a powerful orator who passionately spoke on the need for women's suffrage, racial equality, and the general need to uplift the ambitions of women. In 1919, Ms. Becks had her most memorable performance in a public debate at Ebenezer AME Church, where she and her debate partner, Ms. W.A. Green, argued on the affirmative team in favor of giving women the full right to vote. There were actually two women on the other side who argued against the proposition. Ms. Becks and her partner not only won the debate, they helped win the battle for women's suffrage in 1920. After the passage of the 19th Amendment, Ms. Becks furthered her quest to uplift women by creating the first Young Women's Christian Association for African-American women in Kansas City, Kansas, and then later in Kansas City, Missouri, known as the Paseo YWCA. Her pursuit of civil rights and equal opportunities for Black women and men continued until her death in 1953 at the age of 73. We are grateful for the legacy of Ida Bowman Becks and so many others who paved the way for the freedoms we enjoy today.
Hello, my name is Ariana Eckel. In honor of Women's History Month, I would like to present to you the story of Clara Lemlich. Clara Lemlich was a Jewish-American immigrant born in Ukraine who moved to the United States in 1903 when she was just 17. Clara quickly became known as a leader of the Uprising of the 20,000, the massive strike of shirtwaist workers in New York's garment industry in 1909. The International Ladies Garment Workers Union, up to that point, was led by men, and as these male leaders droned on at a large rally called for the women shirtwaist workers, Clara lost her temper and ran to the stage and declared, "I have listened to all the speakers, and I have no further patience for talk. I am a working girl, one of those striking against intolerable conditions. I am tired of listening to speakers who talk in generalities. What we are here for is to decide whether or not to strike. I make a motion that we go out in a general strike." And they did, and they mostly won. Ultimately, Clara suffered broken ribs from the company thugs, was blacklisted from the industry, and found herself at odds with the conservative leadership of the ILGWU. She continued with labor activism and devoted herself to the campaign for women's suffrage. Like her colleagues Rose Snyderman and Pauline Newman, Lemlich portrayed women's suffrage as necessary for the improvement of working women's lives, both inside and outside the workplace, and is quoted as saying, "The manufacturer has a vote. The bosses have votes. The foremen have votes. The inspectors have votes. The working girl has no vote. When she asks to have a building in which she must work made clean and safe, the officials do not have to listen. When she asks not to work such long hours, they do not have to listen. That is why the working woman now says that she must have the vote." Clara remained as an organizer to the very end of her life. She even helped organize the staff of the nursing home where she resided in her old age. I hope you have enjoyed the story of Clara Lemlich. To learn more, tune in to the Heartland Labor Forum Thursdays at 6.
90%